Hey everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, January 18th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, I had a chance to chat with Kevin Roos. He's the news director at Fusion, and he's also an executive producer and co-host of the new show Real Future, which is an original TV series about technology and the future, produced at Fusion by Citizen Jones. And the reason that I am extra excited to talk to Kevin about Real Future is because I am also involved. I'm a co-host on the show. It just recently aired, and you can find segments online. We will tell you all about it in just a bit. But first, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible and free to download week after week. So I want to start by thanking Marcella Liddick. And then over on the Patreon portal, I want to thank a bunch of you folks, starting with Phil Tiber, Timothy Glover, Malcolm Waddy II, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart, and also from the chorus of people who are listening right now. Thank you. You've made the show possible this week. If you want to support the show, you can do it in one of many ways. You can visit carasantamaria.com, where you'll find the Patreon portal, also the PayPal button. Those are just two different ways you can support. One is by going on an episodic support structure, and one is either one time or monthly. You can also click through to the Talk Nerdy store where you can shop around. All of that money goes to support the show. And lastly, you can just tell your friends. You can rate and review on iTunes or all the many apps that you use to listen to the RSS feed. And yeah, guys, it all helps. And again, I thank you so much. All right, I'll stop yammering in your ear and I will go ahead and introduce my guest this week. Here he is, Kevin Roos. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me on Talk Nerdy. I'm looking
thank
forward
you
to
for
chatting.
Having me.
Yeah, it's been too long since I've seen you. It's so weird when you work on a TV show together because you spend like an inordinate amount of time together for a very short period, and then you're like, "Okay, bye."
Yeah, it's very weird to me. Like the whole, I've never done a TV show. This is my first one, and so like the whole time scale is just so wild.
Yeah,
like, it's like, you know, to me, it feels like astronomy or something. Like things are measured in like light years instead of like feet or inches. And it also like, you know, means that everything just happens all at once. And then there's a lot of waiting when the thing is actually produced. And then you see stuff. So like our first episode came out this week, and like, I'm like, I don't even have those clothes anymore. You know, like I don't even look like that anymore. Because it was taped like 6 months ago.
It is weird when you finally see something go to air, because to everybody else, it's just new. It's just now happening. And I have to remind myself sometimes to like promote shows that I'm on and to like be like, look at this great thing I'm doing right now, because it's so long ago, I don't even remember like what's in the episode.
I know.
Super well, odd.
And I've been, you know, editing these too. So I've been like, I've probably seen each of them like 30 times now. So like, I can't tell whether they're whether it's the best TV show ever made or like a piece of shit that no one's gonna want. You know, like I just have no idea. I've watched it so many times.
I love that. And you know what? The hardest thing for me when I first started moving into the production side and not just being like pure talent on camera was actually being involved in the edit, because listening to your own voice and seeing your own face over and over and over, especially the way that the editor will have to stop, rewind, and you hear yourself talking like the same phrase over and
over. Oh, it's atrocious.
It's horrifying.
Like, does anyone enjoy that? Do you think like,
oh yeah, I'm sure there are like totally.
You think like Jimmy Fallon watches himself and he's like, I'm pretty good.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know about him particularly, but there is a certain amount of narcissism that's like required to work in television. And I think that some people full on experience that. And the truth of the matter is, I get feedback all the time, like, you have to watch yourself. And I'm like, I don't want to. I can't. Like, no, but you have to watch yourself. I'm like, it's a chore for me to sit down and watch a finished episode of something that I did. But it's the only way to get better. But I think there's some people who are like, yeah, I look good. I sound good. Just so weird.
Like, if only we had that confidence.
Exactly.
Someday.
I can't even, you know, half the reason I say all the time on my podcast, I don't really edit. Like, I'll edit once in a blue moon if there's like an atrocious sound fuck up or like, you know, I have a coughing fit in the middle, I'll edit it out. But it's really rare that I will go back through and do any sorts of cuts in it. And the majority of the reason that I don't edit is because A, I'm lazy, and B, I don't want to listen to the episode again.
Right.
It's no, like that, so much
that's
work.
That's exactly true.
Yeah. I just spent an hour talking. Now I got to spend another hour listening to the things I just said. No thanks. But anyway, we've been talking about this TV show, and of course, I will package the episode and say what it is you do at the top. But you know, let's take a step back and maybe you can let everybody know what the show is, what it's about, and just what the hell we're talking about.
Sure. So the show is called Real Future. It is a 16-part documentary series about technology and science and the future and weirdos who are living on the fringes of the technological future. So basically, it's the story of technology told through people rather than gadgets or companies. And that was really important to me. And Alexis Madrigal, my producing partner on this, is that we not make a show about TV, about technology that was like just showing gadgets in action. Or just interviewing, you know, CEOs and people in white lab coats from MIT. It was really important that like we get out into, you know, the country and find these people who may not be famous, who may not be rich, but are doing really interesting things around science and technology. So we've been filming this now for about a year. You were, of course, instrumental in that. You're one of our four co-hosts. And I think it turned out amazingly well. Like I really, you know, there's not much to compare it to. There's never really been a show about technology like this before, but maybe as this vanity, but I think it's sort of like up there with some of the best stuff that's ever been done on TV about technology.
It's really beautifully shot. I will say that the production company, Citizen Jones, that you guys chose to work with on this show, it has this very cinematic aesthetic, which I appreciate. So when I saw, and I still haven't seen all the episodes, but I got a couple of clips sent to me so that I could see them ahead of time. And it's just, there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of really tight shots of people's eyes. There's like fun things that are done with camera pans and with like frame rate speed. And it's just got a really beautiful quality to it, which I enjoy, which I think oftentimes you don't think of when you think of tech. You think of like glossy and, you know, like hero shots. And this show, I think, has almost like a grit factor to it and a film quality to it that I really like. And it's actually emotional because, like you said, it's the stories of the people who are either utilizing the technology or to whom the technology is central to their lifestyle. And so there's, you know, you get the feels with some of these episodes, which I quite
totally
like.
Well, yeah. And those dudes, Citizen Jones, our production company, I mean, they're so good. They were sort of documentary filmmakers, and we brought them in because we loved what they shot. It was all beautiful shit, and they, you know, they have these amazing devices called Ronins that sort of like, you know, stabilize the camera, makes it possible to do these really artistic, you know, sort of zoom in, zoom out shots. I mean, it just looks really good.
Yeah, and it's getting to the
that
point.
That was one of the things that was important to us.
For sure. It's getting to the point in filmmaking where I'm learning, you know, because right now I'm working on four TV shows because I'm a crazy person and apparently don't like sleeping. And I'm learning that we are moving into this future where we can use drones instead of cranes, and we can use like the Ronin, which is a really cool robotic Steadicam, and there's a couple different iterations of it, but we can use that instead of dolly shots, so we can do things that look really expensive with much more manageable equipment, because that is how, you know, technology democratizes with time. It gets less expensive, and people are able to get their hands on things that previously only the very, very rich or the very, very powerful would be able to get our hands on. So now we can make beautiful television that looks like a beautiful movie because we have the equipment available to us.
Totally. And I think that, like, you know, we've seen sort of a bifurcation of TV. Like, there's stuff that looks like really, really shitty out there. Yeah. You know, like a lot of like internet video is just like, you know, one camera and a microphone and like pretty gritty. And there's a lot of documentary storytelling that happens that way. Like, I don't know if you've been watching like Making a Murderer.
Been? Oh, Netflix. I finished that like a month ago. I was
Me too.
I binge watched that in like 2 days and was literally throwing things at my TV.
No, I loved and hated it so much.
Yeah.
But if you like just think about the aesthetic of that show, like it's really ugly, right? Like most of the footage is from like courtrooms in, you know, like 10 years ago.
Or like, you know, what we think of as like the handy cams that we were using with the big VHS tapes in them, because a lot of it is like home movie footage from the 80s.
Totally, totally. And so I feel like there's a quality to that that's verite that people really like. It feels very authentic. And then there's this sort of opposite pole, which is like this beautiful sort of narrative style documentary making that we wanted to do, which is like stuff that looks like cinematic almost.
Yeah.
But it's still very much real. Like this is not scripted. We went out to these places and talked to these people, as you know, and like, and I think it's a really nice mixture. You have sort of like the verite feel of the stories themselves, but then it also looks great.
Oh, for sure. And I really enjoyed doing it. It was fun to meet all of the different characters that we got to interview. I know some were more fun than others. You know, there were some kind of characters that were a little bit intense from what I heard talking to you guys about some of those stories. But I want to ask you before we even get into the content and really about your background, I want to make sure that my listeners know more about you. And I guess the first question would be, what made you decide when you were first talking to Alexis about doing this show? What made you decide, okay, we want to produce this show, we want to tell these stories, but let's also be in front of the camera? Because that's scary, especially since you said you've never done TV before.
Right. Well, I started out as a writer. Like, I'm a writer by sort of temperament and nature.
Yeah, you've written two books, haven't you?
I wrote two books. I used to write about religion. Then I wrote about banking and finance. I wrote a book about Wall Street. I was the tech columnist at New York Magazine. And then I moved out to California. And when I moved out here, I met Alexis, who was the sort of lead tech writer and an editor at The Atlantic. And we just started talking about sort of our ideas and what we wanted to see. And eventually we both ended up getting sort of approached by Fusion, which is this, you know, upstart media company aimed at sort of diverse young people. And they were interested in our coverage and said, you know, would you guys like to make a TV show together? And neither of us had ever done this before. And we were both sort of like, all right. And I was sort of thinking, okay, Alexis will be in front of camera. Like, I'll be producing behind the scenes, like, you know, it'll be sort of like a two-man show here. But we quickly realized that, like, our schedules were just not going to accommodate that. He wasn't going to be able to go out on every shoot. And I was going to need to get in front of the camera. So I sort of ended up on camera by accident on this.
Gotcha. Was it begrudging or were you like, okay, I could try this?
No, I mean, once I knew it was like sort of an inevitability, I like came around to it. And actually, I think it's kind of fun, but it's just like so nerve wracking. It's so much different than being behind the scenes as a writer. And it also, you know, like it's very high pressure and it's also very time consuming. Like, as you know, these shoots go for, you know, sort of 2 full days. And when you're making 16 mini documentaries, like, that's just a lot of time.
Yeah.
It was not as painful as I thought it would be. I actually ended up enjoying it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, the painful part comes later when you have to sit and edit.
Yeah, exactly. For sure.
And Alexis he's such an interesting character too, because, you know, I had read a lot of his stuff previously before he even came to Fusion, but I had never seen him, which is so common, right? When you see a byline, you don't really associate the way somebody looks, the way somebody dresses, their mannerisms. You don't think about those things, especially when we're talking about journalism, because the writer might have a tone and a flavor that appeals to you. You know, oftentimes we find ourselves kind of being drawn to columns or being drawn to articles that are written by the same writers because there's something in their voice that speaks to us. But they themselves are often an enigma. You know, we don't know what they look like. We don't know how they carry themselves. But Alexis himself is a character. Like, he's kind of meant to be on TV.
Oh, totally. I mean, he's much more, you know, what do they call it, telegenic than I am.
I wouldn't say that. I just think that he doesn't look the way you'd expect him to look. You know what I mean? He's
right.
Very street. Like, he has a very right. street vibe to him, which you're like, oh, well, obviously
which is
that's him.
Hilarious that you say that, because I know him and like hear him talk about, you know, the car seats in his Volvo and stuff like that. But yeah, he has tattoos. He looks he looks like he should be hosting like a gritty documentary show about technology. I don't know. It worked out really well.
Yeah, he looks like he shops like on Melrose. Like, there's just a vibe to the way that he dresses, which was very like almost like skate, like street cool. I don't know. And so when I first saw him on camera and he was wearing like a beanie and like a button down, like a really loud button down shirt with like the top button buttoned, I was like, oh, you're very stylish.
I know. Well, he lives in Oakland, which is, you know, which is sort of the Melrose of the Bay Area.
That's true. Oh yeah. And you guys are in the Bay Area. So that's probably why I haven't seen you lately.
Exactly. Well, I want to ask, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
So we did 16 of these. I forget how many exactly you hosted, but I think it was like maybe 7 or 8.
Yeah, it was like half. Like, it was so crazy.
No, it was huge. And like, which of those 7 or 8, like, which was the most fun and the least fun?
Oh gosh. Okay, let me think. And you mean in terms of my experience shooting it, not in terms of what I thought was like the best story, but like what was the most fun to shoot?
Yeah.
Well, I did really enjoy shooting the VR episode because it was exciting for me. I have struggled with virtual reality for years. So I've been working, you know, it's weird because you're in the tech space, which obviously is much bigger than it sounds like when we hear the word tech. You know, you're not a gadget reporter. It's much more than that. And I'm in the science space, which I think has similar growth period to it. But a lot of people from the outside think that science and tech are the same thing. And partly that's because of the way that newspapers have approached it. They've closed science desks or they've merged. And so now you see sci-tech as a vertical in a paper or online. But the truth of the matter is science and technology have a lot to do with each other, but the reporting is almost always separate. And so I approach this from as a science reporter, and you guys approached it as tech reporters, which I think offered some really cool perspective. That being said, I have done a lot of stories on the science of virtual reality in the past. And I remember going to USC's ICT, so the University of Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies, like years ago, and interviewing one of the guys who was instrumental in creating Oculus, like long before Oculus had a name. And I was wearing this crazy VR headset with like antennas sticking out of the top and a backpack and walking around the lab in it. And I had to take it off every 3 minutes or I would puke all over my shoes. Like, it was just horrible. And since then, there have been incremental improvements, but I always get sick when I wear VR headsets. I'm just one of those people, can't read in the car, can't go on windy roads. I get sick really, really easily with motion sickness. And VR sickness, as I've learned, is a really interesting component, which I'm going to do a total aside here. Did you know that the reason that you get VR sick is because we always say, oh, well, it's because what's happening to your eyes doesn't quite match what your ears are detecting, you know, your balance in your ears. But and then we end it there. Like, so that's why you get sick. Well, why would that make you sick? It's because your brain thinks that you've been poisoned.
That's wild.
That is what, like, oftentimes when you eat poisonous, like, berries and shit, it'll give you this mismatch where your ears and your eyes don't match. And so your body, when that happens, tells you to vomit because they want you to get the poison out of your system. That's why you feel so sick that's why VR sickness is a thing. So anyway, totally wild.
Jesus.
Super weird. And
who
so
knew?
I've always had that, and it was fun for me doing the VR episode because we got to see cutting edge now VR software. Oculus is an amazing hardware, but now the software is finally catching up. And I even got to spend time with the headset on that allowed me to like legit wear it for long periods of time and enjoy myself and not feel like I was going to vomit the whole time. So for me, that was the most fun.
Totally. Well, and like for background, like this was an episode about like, I mean, mostly when we hear about VR being used and Oculus coming out and stuff like that, it's around like gaming and movies and like, you know, immersive experiences yeah. for entertainment. And this episode was about like medical uses of VR. Mm-hmm. So there's a, you know, you went and talked to this dude, Fernando, who's like a psychologist. He's using VR to like cure people's phobias. You want to explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was crazy. He developed this software. Like, I think he focused on a few main phobias that people struggle with. One of the biggest ones is heights. And so he developed a software which allows you to experience going up in a very tall elevator, stepping out on a platform, looking down over the city, and do it in a safe environment, right? Because you can stop at any time, you can remove the headset at any time, and you can keep kind of reminding yourself, this is virtual, this is virtual. But as anybody who's ever experienced VR knows, you're there. Like, it's right. fully immersive because with the headphones on, with your full vision, right? Because the way that Oculus works, it covers your whole field of vision. It's not like a cardboard where you can still kind of look to the sides. And so you're there, but there's no real risk. It's only that your brain is convincing you that there's a risk. So it's a really good form of therapy because you can put yourself in these situations where you have a perceived risk, but you don't have a physical risk. Right. And there was also one where the walls would close in on you, which is super uncomfortable.
Well, and in the episode, we actually see this dude who's like a patient of this psychologist, and he has a phobia of heights, and like he puts the Oculus on and like goes up in the simulator, and he starts like bugging out.
Oh, totally. Like, I'm fucking bugging out for him. Like, I'm watching him and his like palms are really sweaty and he's like breathing really hard, and Fernando's really great with him, you know, to walk him through it and to make sure that he's comfortable the whole time. But like, oh my god, yeah, it's real. Like, I was right. a little freaked out, and I'm not even afraid of heights.
I mean, so the idea is not just that you're like scaring the shit out of people, it's that like you're like you're like coaching them through this, and each time you do it, it gets a little easier, and like eventually you get over your phobia?
Yeah, I mean, you work on it, you know. It's like it's a work in progress. I think the interesting thing is that for TV, of course, this guy who like agreed to come and do this, we're like, let's send him to the top, you know, like dicks. But in a real therapy session, it would be very slow. You would be a few floors that day and then talk about your experience and kind of decompress after, and it's a full session. And then you come back a week later and you do the same thing again, and maybe you get a little higher up, and maybe you like, you know, move out on that platform a little bit more and kind of look over the side a little bit more than you could before. So it's a process. But of course, for TV, when you have 3 hours to shoot that one scene, and the guy was very nice that we found, I guess, even casted on the internet, that's really common now, was like, yeah, I'll try it. You know, I'm scared shitless, but I'll try it because I think this could be really good for me. And so he tried it, and he was a total trooper, and he did feel good after, I think. He was freaked out, but he was like, this is really helpful, which yeah. is great.
Yeah, that was awesome, because it was also just like a story of technology just like helping people. Like, I think we hear a lot of like sort of vague things about like technology, like, you know, making our lives longer and making, you know, things easier for people. And,
yeah.
But like, it's rare that you actually see like a single person who has a problem in their life, and then they like alleviate that with technology. Like, it's not all that rare, but it's like pretty rare.
Well, it's not the norm, right? When we think about technology, we can put ourselves in those shoes, right? I had this moment, like, I guess 5 years ago, I was new in LA. I had a meeting with Science Channel, which is part of Discovery, and they're in Silver Springs, Maryland. And it was like the middle of winter. And so I flew out, and I think I had a friend come down. Yeah, my best friend was in Philly going to med school at the time. And so she came down, and we got a hotel room in DC. And then we had to take the subway to Silver Springs, Maryland, and it was like a blizzard and it was crazy. And I remember we were standing on the subway platform on our way there. It was freezing cold. We couldn't feel our nose or our fingers or our toes. And we had this like epiphany of like, Can you imagine what this would have been like 5 years ago when we didn't have iPhones? Like when we couldn't just turn on Google Maps and walk to the building because we knew where we were. Like if we had paper maps and we were trying to navigate to this office in this city that we don't know, where it's freezing fucking cold. Just everything's harder when it's really cold outside and snowing and wet everywhere. And just that moment of, holy shit, my life would suck without this. But oh yeah, we had that for years and years and years and we were just fine. I mean, it's definitely easier totally. Now.
I mean, that's why I think it's so crazy when, like, you know, Donald Trump and like other conservatives are like, you know, remember how America used to be great? You know, yeah, and I'm like,
no, it's
you motherfuckers didn't even have Wi-Fi. Yeah. Like, get out of here. Like, it's I would so never true. Go back to 19, you know, 52 or whatever they want to do. Like, you know, if you were lost, like you just were lost.
Oh, totally.
You know?
Like, I think about things. I drive in a fully electric vehicle. I drive an electric car. I don't want to ever get gas again. Like the idea of having to go to a gas station again is horrible to me. It's just horrible. Like the fact that people have to get oil changes, I'm like, that's so antiquated. There's
totally.
Just-
well, and like remember like, you know, I don't know, maybe you don't remember. I was, when I was a young man, like 10 years ago, I remember like there would just be times when you would like, you know, meet up with a friend and like you, like they were late or somebody got held up or turned out they like, couldn't come after all. And it was like a whole process of like how to get in touch with them.
Yeah. It was just like you wait and you look at the clock. And I remember definitely having these experiences. You look at your watch, right? Not your clock on your phone, your watch. And you go, I'm going to give them until 3:17. And if they're not here by 3:17, I'm out.
Right.
Those fuckers. Right. Yeah. No, so true. Everything was tougher. Everything was harder. And so, you know, we think about the fact that these technologies, they do help us. Obviously, they've transformed our worlds in ways that it's actually really hard for us in hindsight to put our fingers on. But then you see a story about a guy who like lost his fucking legs in Iraq and gets like bionic legs. And you're like, oh, shit, that right. is technology making this guy's life transformatively better, giving him back something that he lost. And those kinds of stories, the medical stories, I think really touch me in a deep way because there is a huge human component and an emotional component to them. The second half of that shoot that I did with the doctor, I think, unless this made its way into two episodes, but I don't think so, was when I visited UCLA and I got to learn about surgical theater.
Oh, that was awesome.
Freaking amazing. So surgical theater is this hardware software duo that surgeons can use where they basically layer in all of these MRI and CAT images to get a full 3D rendering that's fully colorized of the patient, whatever it is. In this case, we're looking at brain surgery. So it was a full rendering of the patient's brain, including their tumor. And then the doctor can wear the headset, fly around in your head so they can learn your architecture and really start to understand it. That way, when they go in to do surgery, they're much more familiarized with the mapped space of your brain. And like two things that amazed me. One, the doctor said to me, and I got to fly around in this like real patient's brain and see his real tumor, which was fucking crazy. And then I met the patient, which is even more crazy. One, the doctor said to me, it's kind of like when you go to somebody's house for the first time and it's a bit awkward and unfamiliar and you're like, where's the bathroom? And then you have to like fumble your way to the bathroom and you're like, can I get a drink of water? Sure, the cups are in that cabinet. And you're like opening every cabinet to find them. And then if that's like becomes a good friend of yours and you spend more and more time with them, you just know where everything is. You don't even have to think about it. You could do it in the dark. And that's very much what the experience was like for him. You have to familiarize yourself.
Right. So they're doing this before every brain surgery. They like make a 3D map of the person's brain. They like go into it with Oculus and they can just basically like swim around in the brain.
Mm-hmm. And it's very new. Like not many hospitals have it, but it's getting to be more and more commonplace. It's bizarre.
Well, and what I loved about that part of it and like what surprised me, this dude's old. Like he's an old doctor.
Yeah, you know? That's
he's like
true.
Probably
he was,
in his
he was not like
60s or 70s.
Yeah.
This was not some like young upstart techie. This is a guy who like is a renowned brain surgeon.
Yeah, he's the chief of neurosurgery at UCLA, which is like a huge
right.
title.
And he saw that this technology was there and could make, you know, make results better and lower the error rates or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like, and he just jumped on it.
Yeah,
and
there
now
was no hubris
like
there. There was definitely like, hey, I don't need to prove myself. Like,
right.
if this is going to make me better at my job and give me better outcomes, how could I not do it?
Which, like, I'm definitely not going to be that way when I'm when I'm in that part of my career. Like, I'll be like, these kids with their, you know, their holograms and their, like, I'll be so grouchy. And,
yeah, you'll be like, give me the pen and paper.
Right. Right. Where's my quill pen? Right.
No, it's true.
No, I loved it. So what was your least favorite? What one did you hate?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know what's funny? Vocaloids was my absolute, it might be my favorite in terms of outcomes, maybe that, and weirdly the one about sex and relationships and camming. They were just really beautiful and meaningful to me. But like, Vocaloids was definitely my hardest shoot, I'll say, yeah. Because it was...
So that was the one that I came on with you.
Yeah, you were there. And so it was...
So let's talk about that, because we have a lot... We never debriefed that, but that was that was bananas.
I love it. So. Yeah, let's talk about... like. Guys, you're just kind of listening in on our conversation right now. That's like a legit conversation because we haven't talked about this. Okay.
So to set the scene a little bit... Vocaloids are this sort of Japanese pop music phenomenon, and they are these like synthetic pop singers, would we call them, that are like basically they're created with music writing software. So you get like, you actually buy a piece of software called Vocaloid, and that allows you, anyone who has the software can like write a song using the Vocaloid's voice. And then they like animate it with like an anime avatar, and they like perform, and like Vocaloids give concerts in Japan that like sell out these like enormous stadiums. And like the most popular Vocaloid is this one Hatsune Miku, who's got like, you know, millions of dollars in merchandise sales, is like the most famous celebrity in Japan, and it's a fucking hologram.
Yeah,
like it's there's no real person involved with it. It's just music that's written by the fans using this software, and then they like put like a little teenage girl avatar on it, and that's like what performs on stage.
And the funny thing is, like, you may have heard of this before or you may not have. So if you haven't heard about it, you're like, holy shit, what is this? If you have heard about it, I've found that in the States, most people who have heard about it in this context. Weird. Japanese people go to concerts with like holograms are not even real. That's weird. I don't get it.
Totally.
But the whole aspect of this being a crowdsourced phenomenon where you can buy the software yourself, you can compose your own songs for this basically placeholder pop star. Like, you know, she is not real. And she does not have a single person guiding her, but it's the entire community that is creating her persona, her wardrobe, her iterations, her love songs, her, you know, her dance songs. And because of that, you really start to understand, as you see these super fans, why this is so meaningful to them, because it's a part of them that they see on stage.
Totally. Well, and like, imagine if you could write a song and like Taylor Swift would perform it.
Yeah.
Like that's basically what they're doing.
It's crazy. It's very, very cool. Like, the more you get into it, the cooler you realize it is. That being said, it's a huge 180 from like what we know about music. And I will interject weirdly to go off topic. I was talking to my boyfriend last night, and he was saying that he was reading an article or an interview with David Bowie from like before the internet was big. It was, we were watching Spotlight, and it reminded us because he had read an article with David Bowie from like around the same time that some of those sex cases, you know, if you haven't seen Spotlight, it's about the Catholic Church and the child horribleness, the kiddie fiddling. But around the same time in the 80s, like Bowie had done an interview, or maybe it was probably the 90s, I guess, because he was talking about how the internet is going to change music. And a lot of times people, when they would talk about how the internet is going to change music, they talk about how it'll change the industry and how it'll change the performers. But Bowie was like crazy ahead of his time. Like, he was a fucking oracle. And he was talking about how it's going to be about the fans and about their ability to give back and to fully participate. And I was like, holy shit, he's describing Vocaloids. Like, David Bowie was describing Vocaloids in like 1990. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
Anyway, that being said.
So yeah, we still have to debrief this shoot because it was not like a normal shoot. So first of all, like, I came up with this crazy idea for a story on Vocaloids. not even really knowing if it could be done. It turned out there was like this huge Vocaloid meetup happening in LA at this anime conference.
Oh my God, Anime Expo. Oh God.
And like, let's just try to paint the picture of Anime Expo. So the first thing I like pull into the parking garage and immediately there's like a Dragon Ball Z dude like like walking with his girlfriend who's not dressed up at all, by the way. She's like in her normal clothes.
And like rolling and her eyes, I'm
and
sure.
And he's, she looks so embarrassed to be with this guy, which, you know, is understandable because he was like in full Dragon Ball. Like he had this spiked hair. Like, I don't know how, I mean, he looked good, but it was quite a sight. So there are like 10,000 people at this thing. Most of them are in costume. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's bananas.
It's like for anybody who lives over where we live, if you've been to Comic-Con, it's like a smaller version of Comic-Con in Los Angeles. Like it's the full-on thing, right? But there's a difference, I find, between Comic-Con and Anime Expo, that Anime Expo is still small enough that it's totally commercialized, don't get me wrong, but it's not like mainstream like Comic-Con. Like you don't have like celebrities there. You don't have big brands there being like, oh, it's so cool, we're in the blah, blah booth at Comic-Con. Like it's still just fans and it's hard fucking core. And there's so many of them and it smells like open ass. And it was 4th of July, mind you. And so like, so we're there working all day, like into the night. And it's so funny because we're getting texts of our friends like with firework displays and like, oh, it's so fun. Come to my barbecue. And I'm like, no, I'm hanging out with people in anime costumes. Sorry.
So it was and it was also like a very hard like place to film. There's just like all these restrictions.
Oh, of course.
You can do stuff.
It's like any of my science folks that are listening, we talk a lot, especially on my show, but also on The Skeptic's Guide, right? We talk a lot about having controlled experiments and you know, you want to make sure that you take care of all of the different confabulating factors. And when you're in the lab, you want to keep things clean and you only want to alter this one thing. Like throw that, like production's the same way. When you look at like a really controlled production, they have rigid call times, rigid hit times, rigid break times. And, you know, the gaffers need this much time to set things up and the grips need this much time and the shooter wants to be rolling then, but stop down by then. Throw that all fucking out the window when you're at a place like Anime Expo. It's like, get the shots you can get. Try not to piss off the security guards. Holy shit, what is that person in like a big bionic costume doing crossing our shot? It's just crazy.
Well, and my favorite thing was like, so part of the thing that we did was go to this like concert where this Vocaloid like performed on stage, mm-hmm. and which was fucking incredible.
And it was
I love that part of the show.
It was
just like the weirdest thing.
So weird that I was watching, because this is one of the ones I actually got to see. I was watching the clips with my boyfriend and I was like, just watch my face really carefully. I was like, I would love to see how hard it was for them in edit, because I wasn't going to act. I was going to be in the moment and really experience it. So I'm sitting here between this girl who developed an American Vocaloid and she was adorable and awesome and I loved her and she was kind of the main point of the story. And then this super fan to my right who, because we got the best seats in the house for this shoot, which I'm sure they hated because they're like, you don't even know why you're here. But they were actually so sweet. They gave us their glow sticks and they taught us all the arm motions and I couldn't understand anything because it was all in Japanese and they were all Japanese and I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I'm trying because I'm in the front row to like be excited the way they are, but I have this look on my face of like pure confusion like through the whole
no shit. you look like you just got dropped into like an alien civilization. Yeah. And you're like trying, it's amazing, it's a really amazing thing. My favorite part of that was, so I was not on camera for this segment, I was just helping produce. And like the people at the concert venue for this Vocaloid were like really weirdly sort of protective of like, you know, like we want to like make sure like, you know, Ia is, who is the Vocaloid, is like seen in the right light. And, you know, we want to like make sure you get her from this angle. And like they were like taking care of like Beyonce.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like a fucking hologram. I know. Like she's not, you know, like. I don't know if she has like a rider, you know, like her, like, you know, her projector has to be this many lumens. And like, you know, if it's not, she's going to like storm out. But like, it was as if we were at like a Beyonce concert. But like when the concert started and the music started, there's just like this PowerPoint screen, right? with a moving hologram on it.
My favorite part, I think, was when, it was kind of cool because she's able to do quick changes because she's not real. So it's just a new animation. And so she had different costumes and there were different, you know, tones. Some of the songs were very sad and then other songs were upbeat and happy. But there were a couple of dancers that would come on stage in matching costumes and they were really
human talented dancers.
Girls that were, I say girls because there is kind of this weird vibe that we didn't talk about as much in the show, but I think it did make it on air a little bit. But there is still kind of a weird, I can't tell. It feels pedophilic to me. It might not be. It may be just a huge cultural divide that I do not understand fully, but they all seem like just a little too young and a little too childlike, you know, with the big anime eyes and the proportions being really wrong and her voice is really high-pitched. And so the girls were very much, you know, with pigtails and cute little short skirts and short shirts and, like, tennis shoes. But they were really talented dancers. So that part for me was when you probably did see me light up more was I was actually watching something that, I don't know, did something where it was like, oh, look at these great dancers dancing. Because the rest of the time I was watching a fucking hologram.
But, like, how must it feel to be a backup dancer for a hologram? like... Like, what do you tell your parents at Thanksgiving? Like,
I know.
You know?
But then the weird thing is, all these people were actually from Japan. They were on tour from Japan. They weren't like an American institution. And so what we keep forgetting is that culturally, it's like, it's not only is it totally normal, it's entrenched in such a way that there's a reason it's normal. Because our culture is different. And so we don't fully understand. And that's why I thought it was great that we did have an interview with a PhD professor of what did she study? I can't remember, but she knew about
media anthropologist.
But she knew everything about anime and about kind of the derivative culture of manga and of fan art and fan writings, and she just really understood Japanese art culture and Harajuku and all of that. And so we were able to have a conversation where I think she helped me open my eyes to not be so, because you know we all at first blush are like, oh, that's weird. Ugh. But then we have to try and understand and use empathy to really put ourselves in that place. And it's very hard to do, just like it's hard to understand Israel-Palestine if you've never lived there. It's hard to understand, you know, the plight of somebody who lives in the projects if you've never lived in the projects. And it's hard to understand the perspective of this cultural phenomenon in Japan if you're not from there and you haven't lived it. But I think she did offer a really good voice, which was helpful. And also, our star of the show, the American girl, who was obviously just really into anime and wanted to try and bring the phenomenon to America by designing her own female Vocaloid American character, the first ever with an American accent. She, I think, was a good conduit to understanding that world, because there is still fandom here, but it's a little bit counterculture.
Totally. Well, and I think actually you did a really excellent job of I think, you know, what we wanted this show to be is an illustration of all of these different internet subcultures and how they, you know, weave into the real world, and trying to really understand them and be fair to them and open them up for examination, but not just be oh, these are weirdos doing weird shit.
Yeah.
Really try to understand for the people in that community, what makes this compelling. And I came away from that episode totally getting why someone would be into Vocaloids, even though I am not personally that into Vocaloids. Which I think is there are a couple other episodes of the show where we tried to do that as well. And I think, you know, for me at least, that's what I hope the arc will be of sort of people who watch the show, is you come into an episode, you hear about something like Vocaloids, it sounds totally fucking crazy. And, you know, 12 minutes later, you sort of empathize with the people who are doing this and you realize there's something in it for them.
Yeah, and I think probably the best example of that is the Real Doll episode, because I kind of knew going in that was going to be my experience, because I had read a lot about Real Dolls and I had always really empathized. There's this guy named something Cat, I can't remember his name, Drew Cat or something like that, who everybody's seen on, I guess there were some TLC shows, and they really sort of were hey, look at this freak. He has a Real Doll girlfriend, but he's a normal person. He's really intelligent. He's really interesting. And you kind of start to wonder what is it that he sees in dating a synthetic doll? And so I've always had this unique kind of I feel there's something more to this, and this person's not ill. They're just they're connecting in a way that like mainstream people don't understand. But I really think that you guys as a production team, because I was not really involved in production, I was pretty much just in front of the camera on this project. I really think that you guys told that story in a very compelling, really beautiful way. We brought a guy who would have liked to have purchased a real doll if he could have afforded to. And so
just to back up, yeah. what is a real doll?
Oh yeah. So a real doll, I mean, if you haven't heard of it, Google it. It's crazy, but it's a anatomically correct silicone doll that has like an exoskeleton, or I guess it's not an exoskeleton, it's an introskeleton. But she's bendy in all the right places, and she has like a vagina or a penis, whatever you want. And she's got like full makeup, and she can wear different outfits. She's like life-sized, and they're really expensive, like $9,000 or something. And you can purchase them and basically do whatever you want with them, but it's a huge commitment owning one of these things, because
that's a very good euphemism. Do whatever you want with
yeah
it.
Exactly. No,
people, you have sex with it, like that's
most
the
people
point
have
of
sex
it.
With it. But I love the stories too that are told about, like, I remember the guy who makes real dolls told me this beautiful story about a woman who lost her husband, and she bought a male real doll just to have like a presence around the house, because that's one thing you don't realize until you go to this factory. It feels like there's a fucking person right there, like there's right. a presence.
They're very
to
realistic.
They're very realistic, and there's something about a life-size doll that you'll talk to them when you walk past it. It's very strange. But you also just like always want to grab their butts. Like, did you notice that? Were you there at that shoot?
I was not there.
Oh,
at
you
that
didn't
shoot,
get
but,
to go.
But I know. I missed that one.
Oh, gosh. It's so fun. You're just standing there in the middle of a conversation, and there's like a doll hanging on a meat hook next to you that they're working on, because that's how they work on them. It's totally creepy. Like, they hang on meat hooks, and they're headless until the end. And you'll just find yourself like grabbing its tit, just squeezing. And you're like, wait a minute. Sorry. Like, I don't know why.
Let's be clear. You find yourself just grabbing the tits. Not,
sure.
I don't know that that's a universal
experience. Maybe. I don't know. But it's fascinating.
So the episode is about, that episode is not just about these like amazing sex dolls. It's like the guy who runs this company is trying to give them artificial intelligence. So
yeah.
he's basically using some software to try to sort of animate these dolls and make them more like, you know, like if you've seen like Ex Machina or like, you know, so like the 80 billion other sci-fi movies where there have been like robot lovers, like that's basically what he's now trying to create.
Yeah. So this is like Ex Machina, like 50 years before it's actually like Ex Machina. You know, we're in the early, early stages where you can like hear the servos in their face and like, you know, it still looks really robotic, but it's the beginnings. It all has to start somewhere. And so we're visiting with this guy, learning about how he sculpts them, learning about how people buy them, and then learning about this cool kind of early iteration of a robotic doll who can use artificial intelligence to respond, and you never know what she's going to say because it's AI, it's not scripted. And so we brought in an individual who were like, hey, would you ever buy a real doll if you could afford one? Fuck yeah, I'd love to have a robot girlfriend. That sounds fascinating. We're like, ooh, okay, come on, let's go meet one. And then this thing happens between the two of them in the room, and it's like so beautiful. And
it was really romantic.
It was
I did not expect like a romance story out of this episode.
You know what it kind of reminds me of, and this is also going to feel really like off topic because that's how I am. Have you ever seen the movie, not The Gift, but Gift? And I'm not talking about the new movie Gift. I think there have now been three movies called The Gift, but there's one about Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction. Did you ever see that movie?
I did not.
Okay, so there's this beautiful movie from like, I don't even know, like the 2000s, probably early when Jane's Addiction was big. Ritual de la Habitual, I think, was the big album then. And he makes it with his wife, and they're struggling with heroin, and his wife ODs in the movie and dies, and then he has sex with her dead body. It's like a fucking movie about necrophilia, and it's so beautiful. Like, you watch it and you're like crying and you totally get it, and you're in the moment with him, and you just see how much he loves his wife, but he's having sex with her dead body. And you're like,
to be clear,
oh my God, I love it.
There is no necrophilia.
There is no necrophilia in this, but there is something necrophilic about it to me. There is something very like artifice, but because it's like a fear of the unknown that I think a lot of us have. And so this episode really shows me, and not just the episode. I mean, the episode does a great job in edit and in post, but I'll tell you, in the moment while I was shooting it, it was a moment that was so sweet and loving when he's like asking her if she wants to be his girlfriend. And she's like, I thought you'd never ask. And you see this like look in his eyes and you kind of want to cry. You're like, I'm so happy for them. And then you're like, what the fuck?
And like, right. And I had that experience too of coming in and being like, oh my God, what a loser you'd have to be to like, you know, want a robot girlfriend.
Yeah.
But like, you know, and I'm a little sheepish about admitting this, but like, I have like, you know, I have one of those Amazon Echo things in my house. Mm-hmm. You know, the, have you seen these that like you put it on your counter and you can like talk to it and it talks back. It's basically like Siri attached to like a speaker.
Yeah. And then it can, you can sort like stream
always
music
on
and stuff.
In your house.
Gotcha.
And like, I use it all the time. And the woman, the like artificial intelligence in there is, her name is Alexa. And like, I talk to Alexa like probably like 20 times a day, like not like having conversations, but like, you know, like set a timer for me when I'm cooking or like whatever, you know, remind me to like take out the trash or whatever it is. And like, I would be sad if like, you know, Alexa was like, you know, talking, like saying something to me and, you know, then all of a sudden died or like,
yeah,
you know, like it's not an emotional connection, but I do feel like I can totally see how you could form an emotional connection with a robot.
For sure. And that's just a box on your counter. Like, imagine if she was beautiful.
Right.
You know what I
right.
mean?
Right. It's, imagine if she had a body and she could, you know, hug you and she could, I mean, just like, I think we're going to have a lot of this like happening in the next kind of like 20 years where we're going to like, you know, we're not quite to the like uncanny valley of,
oh yeah,
you
know, she's full like, on in the uncanny robots. Valley. Like, she's freaking me out still, but for some people, I guess.
Yeah. But I actually don't think like robots will have to be as realistic as humans for us to be able to fall in love with them. Like, I think they could get like 85% of the way there and like there'd be a substantial number of people who would be like down with that.
Oh, I agree. And I think that, I mean, I think the trick is keeping them either before or after the uncanny valley, right? After is hard to achieve, but just keeping them on this side of it. And I think that that's what the Real Doll guy has done such a good job of doing, because he says like overtly, these are dolls. We try to keep them looking like dolls. They have big eyes. Their proportions are a little bit off. We're not trying to make them perfectly human. We're trying to make them dolls. And in being Barbie-like dolls, there's a youth quality to them and a not quite real quality to them that actually makes them less creepy. As you start to, there's a handful of them though, because they're custom made, that are approaching being really real. And you're like, ugh, because it looks like a fucking person, but who's just like dead in the eyes.
Right.
And that's when things get a little weird. But soon we'll be able, once they can be animated, I mean, and he's talking about down the line just doing things that are so simple, but that will make a huge difference. Making them subtly breathe, giving them body warmth. Things like that, that if you were sleeping with this doll in your bed, would make it feel human.
Totally.
I mean, it's
well,
fucking
crazy. I have a very important question for you, Kara, about robot sex dolls.
Yes.
So, and this is something that my girlfriend and I talked about a lot when I thought that I was going to be, there was a period where I thought I was going to, scheduling was going to make me the host of this segment.
Gotcha.
And the discussion was had just sort of as an aside, is it cheating if you fuck a robot?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No?
No.
So you would not be upset if your boyfriend hooked up with a robot?
I mean, I might be upset if he didn't ask me if I wanted to like join first. You know what I mean? But then if I was like, hey, dude, if that's like going to take some of the pressure on me off of me, I might be like, sure. I just feel it's cheating if they lie about it.
Got it.
You know
and
what
it
I mean?
It wouldn't matter if it was like a really realistic robot that had, you know,
like really good AI. No,
really good AI.
I don't think so. Okay, the thing is, if you try to keep it a secret and you lie, that's when you feel for me, the betrayal doesn't come from the act. The betrayal comes from the collusion, not the collusion, but you know what I mean? The betrayal right. comes from the secrecy around it. The feeling like you're not allowed to talk to me about what's going on and be able to be open with your concerns or why you need to do this or whatever, because then it's a legitimate conversation that's being had between consenting adults. And to me, it's like, what the fuck ever. But the betrayal comes if like my boyfriend is like, oh, I need to get laid. I'm going to go have sex with this robot because it's less like having sex with a human, but I just won't tell her. Then it's like, you might as well just have sex with another chick.
But that's hilarious.
Is that weird?
I mean, that is truly bizarre. You know, because I think like most of us would agree that like, you know, using like a vibrator is not like an act of infidelity.
But
right?
Some people do. Some people be fucked up. They like walk in on their girlfriend using a vibrator and they'll be like, I feel so wronged. And you're like, are you serious, dude?
That's so funny. I mean, I think a lot of couples are going to break up in 15 to 20 years because one of the partners has sex with a lifelike robot.
Oh yeah, I think
that
will happen.
I'm calling that now. I think it's gonna. I think there's gonna be a lot of relationship counseling that deals with like this very issue. I think it's gonna be like a big thing because like in some ways it's no different than using a vibrator, but like it is actually like if you are feeling emotions towards something, even if it's not feeling emotions back toward you, like there is an element of
infidelity. Yeah, that's true. I've never felt anything for my vibrator except. appreciation in it doing its job or frustration when the battery dies halfway through. That is probably the biggest feeling that I felt towards my vibrator.
So yeah, I can't wait until we have, a reality show where it's just like you remember that Temptation Island show that aired for like a year, like 10 years ago?
No.
Oh my God. Temptation Island, one of the most amazing televised experiences of my life. There was this very misguided reality show on one of the big networks like 10 years ago called Temptation Island where they put like men who were in relationships, like long-term relationships on an island with like single hot women.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
and like had them like hang out and like surprise, surprise, like all of the people like cheated on their partners.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like I want to do the robot version of that in like 10 to 12 years.
Oh, that would be awesome, actually. And you know it would happen.
But, oh, totally.
But also think about how, like, I feel like it could solve so many problems, too, with sexual, like, psychological issues. Like, there's a lot of treatment opportunities for having robot dolls. There's treatments for couples. There's treatments for individuals who might have problems with, pedophilia or things like that. Like, I think that there are really cool options available based on that. Sorry to take things into, like, a bummer area. But you know what it was my favorite part about? I shouldn't say my favorite because it was a super sad moment for me. But the most, let's say, fucked up part about the shoot. Because you weren't there. And I'm not sure if you dug through all of the raw footage. And I don't think it made it into the episode. But there was one point where the guy is interacting with Harmony, this AI robot, and he's asking her all sorts of questions and she's answering and she tells jokes and she loves like science and you can tell that that really like does something for him because he's a big physics nerd. And he's asking her all these questions and at one point he asks her if she like wants to come home with him and she legit answers like, I have a headache. And I was like, oh shit, right? Because she's artificially intelligent. Like, there's no there is an algorithm, but like she's not programmed to say that. She like learns and adapts and finds things to say herself. That's what AI is. It's something that takes off on its own. So she says this unprompted, and this poor fucking guy, I'm like, oh my God. So he's trying to date a robot. It feels like it's a last resort situation. And now this robot is rejecting him.
That's fucked up.
It's so fucked up.
like that's going to happen, though. Like,
I know.
Some of us will be rejected by robots.
And I remember just thinking, like, way to give somebody a complex.
Right?
Like, we got to figure out how to, like, fix this. There's got to be a patch for that or something.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's a programming bug.
It was like, brutal. It was brutal. But also, things are still glitchy. There were points where, because he kept asking her really complicated questions. And we're like, dude, you need to ask her, like, what her favorite color is. Because he kept tripping her up. He would be like, tell me what you know about black holes. And then it was like, oh my God. And she would start like bugging out. She would start giving like a Wikipedia entry about black holes and you could hear her saying like http://, like reading URLs and stuff. And you're like, make her stop.
That's amazing.
It's pretty funny.
I love that one because it's another one of those ones that starts off so weird and ends like totally normal. And,
and
you almost have this experience like I've had this a couple times now and I've been watching episodes of the show where you like end the episode and you like just sit there on the couch for a minute and you're like, wait a minute, that was really fucking weird. And I'm feeling like it's not weird at all. Like you're almost surprised that you're not more opposed to what's happening on screen.
Oh, for sure. There's a moment in your head where you're like, I should get one of those. Like she'd be useful in my house. And then you're like, what the fuck?
Right,
what
right.
am I talking talking about. So, but I have to ask you, because all of the chatterings around these shoots were that one episode in particular was really brutal.
Oh, the one that was in Dayton, Ohio, I think, was the one that you're talking about.
Yeah, and that may... Have you guys aired that episode yet? Was that
we
the
just,
first... You did.
Just
that's the first
aired
airing.
It this week.
Yeah, and I was not in this, and it sounded rough.
It was brutal. I mean, so basically, there's this guy in Dayton, Ohio, named Scott Breitenstein, who runs a huge revenge porn site. So, you know, he hosts this site and people come and they post, you know, like nude photos of their exes that they're trying to use to get revenge on them. And he never takes them down. He has like a strict no takedown policy. And so as a result, this site has become like huge and it's awful. And he's, you know, like doing this to support himself. And so,
and is it legal?
So it's legal to host. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there are a lot of states that have made it illegal to post revenge porn. Mm-hmm. But if you just run a site where other people post it, like, you can't be held liable for that.
Wow.
So I found out about this guy. I got in touch with him. You know, he invited me to come out and sort of like see his whole operation. So we went there, and it was one of the most shocking experiences of my life. I mean, first of all, you arrive there and it's just like, he is exactly what you would expect him to look like. Like, he's got this like mullet and he wears like death metal t-shirts and he's like, you know, he lives in this like very impoverished neighborhood in Dayton, Ohio. And
he was living like in squalor, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was like a hoarder house. Like, yeah. There's just garbage everywhere. And like, and so it's really quite sad. You know, the sort of environment that this takes place in. And then of course, like, when he starts talking about his work, like, it's just disgusting. It's like, you know, he's saying, telling me stories about like, you know, women who, you know, who lost their jobs or whatever after being posted on his site. And he's like almost gleeful about it.
So he really like takes pride in doing this. Like, he has some like deep seated issues with women.
Well,
I'm assuming
it's an interesting sort of origin story, because the way that the site started was not as a revenge porn site. It was a consumer complaints site. So he got ripped off by an e-commerce company. He was trying to buy like a flat screen TV, never arrived. And so he was like, fuck this. I'm gonna like start a website where I can complain about this business and hurt their sales. And so he got really good at like search engine optimization and getting stuff like onto the first page of Google results for any company. And so he just like used for, you know, for years, it was like, this was a site where people would go to like complain about how their like accountant had like ripped them off, or they like their mechanic had like given them a bad, you know, brake pad or whatever.
Yeah.
And then because he wouldn't take stuff down, it started becoming this like revenge porn hub. And it brought him a lot of traffic and a lot of money. And so he just kept doing it. So I think in some ways, like, he still thought like, you know, oh, it's all the same thing. Like, complaining about your mechanic is, you know, complaining about your ex who like cheated on you or whatever. Like, it's all kind of the same thing. Ugh. And so I tried to explain to him like, no, it's actually not the same thing at all. And the most amazing thing happened, which was that on the last day that we were filming, I had sort of prearranged for this woman who was a victim of revenge porn, who had her nude photos posted by an ex. I had her sort of record like a video message to him and just say like, you know, hey, Scott, like, I'm a victim of revenge porn. Like, this is my experience. This is why it's been hard for me. Like, this, you know, this is sort of like what I think about the work you're doing. Mm-hmm. And he watched that video and he like had a conversion moment.
Oh, wow.
Like, he said, you know, she's right. Like, I shouldn't be doing this. And he took down the revenge porn section of his site.
And so, all it took was like one victim's story. It makes you wonder how he had blinders on up until that point.
Well, I grapple with that a lot. And I think it's just honestly that he had never had like actually heard a story of someone's life being affected. Like, obviously, like, women have like emailed him being like, can you please take my pictures down or whatever. But I think like until he actually thought about it and was forced to think about it in moral terms,
yeah,
like, I think that changed his mind. And so, you know, obviously there's still like a lot of nasty shit on his site, and like it's not by any means like a good site now, but it doesn't have revenge porn section on it anymore, which is pretty great. And I think like I did not expect that when I went. And so it ended up being this kind of amazing story of like an internet supervillain who like has a moment of realization about what he's doing.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that was a brutal shoot. Like, just imagine, like, you know, the dead of summer in, like, this, you know, neighborhood in Dayton where, like, you can't really, like, leave your, you know, camera equipment on the sidewalk.
Yeah, and there's, like, cockroaches everywhere.
There's cockroaches, yeah. And you're in this house where it just, like, smells like urine, and, like, there's just garbage everywhere. And you know, these are people who live in poverty. And so it was tough. I mean, that one was, like, it was just hard on so many different vectors. As a filmmaker, it was hard to like, you know, get the right scenes, and then just as like a human being,
it was
just like emotionally very challenging.
And so what was the decision to open the season with that story?
I mean, I think we thought it was the most powerful story.
Yeah.
Just because like you don't really ever hear from people like that.
No, you never hear it from that side, I guess, of the story. You'll hear about the victims, but having the perspective of that person and seeing that moment of them sort of having, you know, a glimpse of realization is really powerful, I think.
Totally. Well, and in a way, it's an interesting sort of thematic thing, too, for the show, because what we really want to do in this show is you know, like portray the ways in which people are... normal people are using technology in extraordinary ways. And that's like certainly the case here. Like this is just some guy with a website, you know, mm-hmm. he's not famous. He's not rich. He's not educated. You know, he's not like a super genius from MIT. He's just a guy who like knows enough about computers to be able to open a website. But because of the scale of the internet and the sort of nature of, you know, like Google indexing and stuff like that, like he has been able to get this enormous amount of power to like make or break people's lives. Because like if your revenge porn is the first thing that shows up when someone Googles your name, like you're not going to get a job.
Yeah.
Like everyone you know is going to find out about that. It's going to ruin your life. And it's happened to thousands and thousands of people. And so I think like it's an extraordinary example of someone who would not have been able to have this much influence were it not for technology and the internet. And that influence can be good and it can be very, very bad.
Yeah, I think it also shows a lot more deep-seated struggles that we have with our culture, with having such an uncomfortable relationship with sex, but also with deep-seated sexism. Because as you know, it's much more common that women are going to be victimized by these kinds of sites and that their lives are going to be destroyed because we hold that kind of sexual sort of imagery of men and women very differently. Mm-hmm. We have very different standards in that way. And so I think there's a lot of deep issues that this opens up that you can take away watching the story. You know, there's a lot of layers that maybe even don't get to be discussed that you get to walk away thinking about, which is obviously really important when you're telling these kinds of stories. And on that note, Kevin, we've been talking for ages, so I have to start winding up. And I think the best way to do it is to ask you the same two questions that I ask everybody who I have on my podcast when we close. So I get to surprise you with them because they're rough. And I'm so excited and interested to hear your take on these questions. So the first one, these are big picture questions, is that when you think about the future, which you've been doing a lot lately, especially in producing this show, what is the thing that concerns you the most? What is the thing that, you know, keeps you up at night and really worries you? And then on the flip side of that, the second question is, what are you most hopeful for and what do you look forward to the most?
I think I'm most scared about is the labor market.
Hmm.
I think that we have not yet begun to reckon with just how many jobs are going to be lost in the next generation to automation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we, you know, we hear stories about, sorry, my alarm's going off here. You know, we hear stories about factories replacing their workers with machines and, you know, people being put out of work by robots in various ways. But I don't think like we've really, there was a study out in the UK that like a third of the jobs in the UK are at risk of being lost to automation.
Jesus. So it's not just what we think of as these like low skill.
It's not low skill manufacturing jobs. It's lawyers, it's accountants, it's white collars, it's blue collars. Like it is a ton of jobs are going to be lost. And I don't think we should like, you know, stop that progress. Like I think in many ways, like, it's not only inevitable, but in some ways good. Like a lot of those jobs suck, mm-hmm. you know? But I don't think that we've made adequate preparation on the policy level for like what to do with all those people. So I think that, you know, politicians especially, but also, you know, business leaders and stuff will have to figure out how to cope with that. I think it's really scary.
I think that's a great answer. And it's one that has never come up in my 90 some odd episodes of the show so far. So that's exciting.
I'm glad. The thing that I am most excited about is self-driving cars.
Oh, yay.
I think self-driving cars are going to be the greatest invention of ours or maybe any lifetime. I mean, I think like I've been writing about this a bit, but I want to write a lot more about it because like, you know, we have like 2 million, or maybe it's either 1 million or 2 million traffic deaths a year.
Jesus.
In the world. Yeah. And so, you know, if autonomous cars can eliminate like 75% of those, which I think is probably a pretty, you know, reasonable estimate, like that's a lot of lives saved in one fell swoop and a lot of lives saved every year. And I think not only is it going to be a huge public health boon to have cars that drive themselves, but it's also going to open up a ton of other sort of interesting social changes. Like, you know, if you can just like, if you don't have to pay attention to the road when you're driving to work, if you can just be on your laptop or watching a movie or whatever, like there's no reason that you couldn't commute, you know, 3 hours each way. Like there's no reason that you couldn't live much further away from work than yeah. you currently do. And so I think it's going to change like urban density. I think it's going to change like, you know, the ways that we sort of choose where we live. Like, I think it's going to be much more influential than people realize. And like the thing that people don't realize, I think, and that I've been learning as I've been talking to people who work in the industry, like we're not a decade away from it. It's like, I mean, we're 5 years away from having fully autonomous vehicles, maybe less than that.
That's so amazing. We were just talking about it this week on Skeptics Guide. So are you excited about like the idea that Apple is getting into this game?
Yeah, I mean, I want my next car to be autonomous. Like, yeah. I don't ever want to buy a car that I have to drive again because I'm a fucking terrible driver. Like, I'm pretty good compared to like, you know, most people. I've never been in an accident. You know, I like, thank God, have like, you know, very, very safe driving record. But like, I'm, you know, humans are bad at driving.
That's
like,
true.
We should not, like, someday our children and our grandchildren will look back and think it was insane that, like, on our 16th birthday, we get a license to drive, like, a 2,000-pound metal, like, killing machine. And, like, there's no checks on, like, what we can do with it. And, like, I think it's totally insane. I mean, I think we will feel like this was an age of brutality in that we were able to drive cars.
It was like a dark chapter in our history.
No, it'll be like, it'll sound like, you know, like lobotomies or leeches or something.
That's true.
Like
it's and just, the stats will line up to it when we're reading the archives. It'll be like, and X millions of people died during this dark period. It's true. But we don't even think about it in our day to day. Because we're like, got to get to work. What do you want from me? That's amazing. No, I love that. Those were great answers, Kevin. And before we go, I want everybody to know where they can find the show, but also where they can find your work, where they can find you to, you know, hassle you online, all that good stuff.
I'm Kevin Roose, R-O-O-S-E, on Twitter. But more importantly, the show, which everyone should go watch, is at realfuture.tv. And We're putting up our second episode tonight, and it'll be coming out. There'll be two episodes going online a week for the next, I guess, 8 weeks. And I think that people will like them. So realfuture.tv, you can see all the episodes as they're released there. There's also a newsletter you can sign up for that will alert you when new episodes go online.
Cool. And will we also be able to eventually see some of these episodes like on YouTube, on Facebook? I know that like there's also the app on iTunes, maybe even on Roku. The Fusion app is going to house some of that content.
Yep. We'll be on Apple TV, Roku, YouTube, and Facebook.
Awesome. Yeah. So you don't have to have cable to be able to see the show. You'll be able to watch it from any of your devices and share it with your friends too. I love that. I'm so excited.
Well, me too.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining me. This is so much fun.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. And everybody, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.